Hey folks, welcome to today's Talkie Bit. As with all of the table Talkie Bits, this is an edit of a live event recording. And so just a couple of things you might want to be aware of heading into this one. As a community, we're experimenting with different venues, trying to find a good post-COVID home. And this particular venue was a bit sonically porous between us and the littles in our community. And so the background noise level is a bit higher than usual. So my apologies if that makes it a bit harder to hear. Also, it ends with me playing a live recording through the sound system we were using that was picked up by the recording device in an ambient way in the room. I think the intelligibility is quite good, but just so you're aware that that is part of the setting as well today. It was a great time together. Glad we can share it this way. Glad you're joining us by podcast. It's good to be with you. Here we go.
As I said in the blurb, this is part last of this series on seeing religions in 3D. I feel like personally I'm having a curiously complicated experience with the relative difficulty of making changes in my life, especially around what I believe, sort of in this season of my life. On the one hand, as I grow, I kind of hate to say grow older because it sounds like I'm going to like launch into this old fart monologue. How about as time passes, I would be staying true to the stereotypes if I kind of became more set in my ways, you know, less inclined to change. That's kind of the way we tell that story, right? But that does not seem to be what's happening. I do find myself becoming more stubborn, but mostly in my commitment to being a changing person, as if you can, you know, fit those two together. I expect that there are people close to me that would tell a different story. I'm also sure they would be correct because I know there are many things in my life that others may wish would change or some that maybe they've even been trying to change for decades. I'm not going to name any of the parties to protect the innocent, but no apparent progress has been made on some of those fronts. You know, so they might be like, yeah, no, they're definitely getting more stubborn. But just when I'm entering this season of life where in some ways people might, you know, cut me some slack if I got curmudgeonly about not changing my beliefs, I feel like I'm having the opposite experience. I feel like I'm on a rocket ride of change. And for the most part, I really like it. It's delightful. To add a little nuance, perhaps, sometimes it's also disconcerting. It's hard for me to know when to let people that are making assumptions about me in on the changes. You know, like when do you sort of stop and say, I think I should probably try to get you up on to speed on what's been happening for me the past while. But I also find that I'm less and less compelled to do that, especially if the place it's coming from is a place of sort of setting people straight about something. Just kind of like, yeah. And maybe that's because one way to articulate the changes that I'm undergoing is to say that I usually experience them as making more room for things like kindness or generosity. I'm not claiming to be kinder or more generous than I was before, but it's more like I can see more possibilities for those things than I could before. I still have to choose them. If they're going to be part of my life, if I'm going to enact them, that's still very much a choice. But the places where the opportunities to live that way are visible to me feel like they're more frequent, easier to access somehow. And of course, a lot of that connects directly with the sort of things, for me at least, with the sort of things we've been exploring together in this series. And in particular, these experiences keep altering the way that I think about how to approach whatever seems to push people away from connecting with one another. And I mean, sometimes we all do that, right? Sometimes we push others away or we make it hard for them to get closer. And sometimes we do that because we feel like we need to do that to keep ourselves safe. It comes from a place of a sense of danger or risk. And that's one of the reasons why we talk about things like boundaries. And as I was kind of reflecting on this, I thought maybe we could use boundaries to illustrate some of how this works more broadly. Boundaries, as important as they are not magical. In fact, like lots of tools that we could apply to self-care, sometimes they can cause as many problems as they solve. Maybe believing in boundaries is like other ways of believing. It's important, and it matters, and it can become problematic if we let it matter too much, if we let it become ultimate or absolute. Because when that happens, we might be in danger of becoming a person defined by their boundaries rather than a whole person who also has some boundaries. So it's a bit of a nuance there. I'm not sure if I'm articulating it well. It feels like it's connected, in my life experience, to I would say the fact that rules without exceptions might not serve us as well in a world where mystery is real and in which random things happen. Our ability to say this is my articulated understanding of that, or my boundary around that, and in this setting or within this experience, it doesn't seem to be quite doing the job. I need to expand that or reconsider that or adjust that. And it's along lines like those that I've been thinking about the absolutizing of religious beliefs and exclusivist claims that kind of thinking can underpin. The particularities of beliefs matter. And in many cases, if we think about our own stories, it's often the particularities that maybe drew us to one belief rather than another in the first place. It was this feature or that feature, this idea or doctrine or concept of something that drew us to a particular belief. But if we take them too far, they can become things that simply push others away or that push us away or boundary us, close us off from others. They can become barriers to the very things that they claim to represent. And so when I think about this from my own religious history, which is in Christianity, I can think of ways in which beliefs in things that had names like love or grace or forgiveness or peace, beliefs about those things became barriers to other people. They actually became boundary markers in ways that were not kind, that were not generous, that did not bring others in but kept people away. And for many people that grew up in or around the Christian tradition, the crux of that dilemma is often, in terms of how we were taught it or why we were taught that it should be a certain way, the crux of that dilemma may well be what we were taught about who Jesus was and how to read the texts that either tell his story or that say that they are words from his mouth. Now, I get that this could open into a whole conversation about what is the Bible, which I'm just going to acknowledge is a thing. I'm going to give you my working understanding of that issue so you know where I'm coming from in what I'm going to say, and then I'm just going to carry on. It's not because I don't think there's plenty there to explore, but just because that's not where I want to land today. For me, and so this is the framework for the things that I'll talk about from that collection of texts, to me the Bible is a library. It's a collection of writings that tell the stories of people's own explorations of what they believe, their searches, their experiences, high points, low points, everything in between. Sometimes the scale of the storytelling in that collection is really grand. It's got a huge scope, and it takes up the narratives of things like the birth and death of nations, certainly the birth of the three sort of Abrahamic religions, if you will, the largest numeric religions in the history of the world. In terms of number of people involved. Those stories are all kind of collected in that collection. Sometimes it's quite intimate. It delves very deeply into personal storytelling. There's fiction. There's even what we might call speculative fiction. For the literature nerds among us, you can contest that if you wish, but I think there's some things there that if they were written now, we would kind of go, that's sort of science fiction, but not quite. So speculative fiction, there's poetry, there's song lyrics, there's collections of wisdom literature, there's apocalyptic literature, there's hagiography, where the stories of significant figures are told in ways that just make them look so absolutely good that it's unbelievable, and it is, in fact, as literal stories go, unbelievable. There's history, there's theology, there's a lot of different things in that library. And mixed into all of that is something that I think we could productively think of as I said in the blurb, the language of lovers. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Probably the most compact examples of language of lovers is the kind of language that shows up in romantic poetry. And just to head this off at the pass, I'm not going to launch into a whole bunch of Shakespearean sonnets here or something. That might be more than even the most romantic among us could handle, at least in this context. So it's a short contemporary example. Poet is someone named Daniel Hoffman. Hoffman died in 2013. An American poet, and the poem is called Yours. I am yours as the summer air at evening is possessed by the scent of linden blossoms, as the snow cap gleams with light, lent it by the brimming moon. Without you, I'd be an unleafed tree, blasted in a bleakness with no spring. Your love is the weather of my being. What is an island without the sea? That's a pretty nice love poem, hey? It's got lots of great lines in it. It's like lots of pretty lovely images in there. Now, it would be an unusual reader, I think, that would encounter that poem and dismiss it kind of categorically because of the literal impossibility of the poet becoming an actual tree or island or starting to smell like linden blossoms or, you know, whatever. That's the kind of language that lovers use for one another. It's the kind of language that philosopher of religion and theologian John Hicks calls the poetry of devotion and the hyperbole of the heart. It's pretty lovely, eh? The poetry of devotion and the hyperbole of the heart. And that's interesting to me, especially as it applies to things like sacred texts. In the corner of the Christian tradition where I grew up, this is not the sort of idea that I can remember ever encountering. Even in my not inconsiderable theological education, I was a long ways down the academic path before I started to run into ideas like this. And I realize that that might just be because of the narrow band nature of that education, but that's my experience. There are certain parts of the Bible that are clearly erotic, unless you're just so repressed that you're compelled to regard them exclusively as analogies or extended metaphors, but we may be less inclined to think about this kind of use of language when it comes to things like the spiritual experiences of those writers who give us the stories that we call within the tradition the Gospels, the stories of Jesus' life and what Jesus had to say and what he did. We don't tend to think about the language of lovers when we think about those texts. But we should. I'm going to contend that we should. I think part of what's lovely about this perspective, this idea of the language of lovers showing up in those kind of spaces, is that it honors the genuine devotion. It honors the ecstatic sense of the writer of having been delivered from the ordinary that lies behind the words. The same way that, I mean, the words in that poem that I read by Hoffman, those are all fairly ordinary words. One of my favorite songwriters, Donovan Woods, and when he talks about his songwriting craft, this is one of the things he says. I try not to write anything in a song that I wouldn't actually say. Like ordinary language. And it becomes about other things. It becomes about the way the language is used, what it points to, what kind of story it tells, what kind of space it leaves for my story, for imagination and all those things, right? So the words in the poems are often, you know, there's when I think about Hoffman's poem, there's not a single word in there that I'd go, I think I need to look that up. It's all very ordinary language. But it is pointing to an experience that is extraordinary, that is transcendent or elevated. And it does all of that. It honors that genuine devotion. It honors that ecstatic sense of being delivered from the ordinary. And it does it without constraining us to read the words literally. It frees us from having to read the words literally. Reading it literally would be like hearing a lover say to their beloved, you know, you are the most beautiful person in the world, and responding with something like, well, I don't know about that. Like, cute? I'll give you cute, but the most beautiful in the world? I don't think so, you know. I once read someone who said that it would take a, quote, wooden-headed literalist to respond like that, right? Like, it's to completely miss the point. Acknowledging the hyperbole of the heart and accepting that this sort of language has merit, that it has a place, can help us make room to understand statements of devotion in ways other than literally. When we start to think about where it came from, how it was offered, then we don't have to be wooden-headed literalists about it. We can be like, oh, this is the language of devotion. Huh. I don't think that person is literally the most beautiful person in the world, and it does not matter one bit what I think. This is not about that. This did not come from there. I wasn't trying to accomplish that. So I want to apply that kind of way of thinking for a bit to this problem of Christian exclusivist claims for a moment. Most of those claims are rooted in what certainly sound like exclusivist statements in the library that is the Bible, in that collection of texts. And it's interesting, you know, a lot gets made out of the exclusivist claims, but there are hardly any of them. There are actually, in all of the New Testament, there are probably about three. So let's pick a really well-known one. This is the kind of exclusivist Christian claim that shows up on billboards alongside the number one, you know, when you're driving across the prairies. John 14:6, if you're a chapter and verse kind of person or you grew up around that. So according to John, who the only writer of that puts words to Jesus' speech, who has Jesus making these kinds of claims, which is also interesting. But in that text, according to John, Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Okay, so to the literalist, That seems abundantly clear. And that's the way lots of the Christian tradition has read that text. The literal understanding would be that what has traditionally been called salvation in that Christian tradition, only available through Jesus. You can kind of, it's not a big reach to see how you could get there from a literal reading of that text, right? Now, just for a moment, think about whatever you might know, whatever sort of fuzzy or maybe crystalline images you have floating around in your head about the character of the biblical writer John the Baptist. This guy was, if he lived now, on a good day, he would be like a neo-hippie. He was a character, as far as we know. If we're going to take that same way of knowing that we know anything about any of the ancients, he was kind of a wild man. He was not a low-key guy. He would for sure fit right in with make your own clothes, grow your own veggies, ride your bike everywhere sorts of ideologies in a contemporary Western world. He was not afraid of public symbol making, like unabashed about inventing symbols. This is the guy who basically single-handedly gave us the symbol of full immersion baptism. For John, as far as us working with what we have, Jesus answers a whole bunch of long-standing questions within his tradition of origin about how this long-held mythology of a coming Messiah would be resolved. Like, it was John's experience with this Jewish rabbi, Jesus, that answered all of those questions for him. And not kind of, you know, but full on. He was sold, like hook, line, and sinker, if that's a meaningful image for you. He didn't swallow just the bait, he swallowed the whole apparatus. He was all in. So, when somebody who has that kind of an experience puts words into the mouth of Jesus, and again, he's the only writer that has Jesus making exclusivist sounding messianic claims in the whole library, one way to understand that is as his genuine expression of, I've found the way that I'm looking for. Jesus is my way to connect with God. Like, I'm in love. I'm in. This is it. It's an ecstatic expression of his experience of that connection with this character. The language of the heart, the language of lovers. In the actual text, even in translation, it holds together pretty well. This phrase, the way, is kind of important. Because the way is what people talked about when they were trying to describe early Christians. They said, these people are followers of the way. So at a great distance, historically, a pretty relevant question is, what was the way? Like, what were they doing? What was actually the thing that gave them this cultural distinctive that other people would look at them as a group and say, those are followers of the way? Well, for John, and for a lot of the rest of the New Testament, the way, and we've talked about this all the way through this series, is all about transformation. It's all about changing from one identity to another. That's really the centerpiece of the way. And in the Christian tradition, the way that that transformation happens in terms of imagery is around these images of death and resurrection. It's one of the reasons why John invented a symbol like baptism, because it felt like a really great way to express that value in the tradition that was just kind of coming to be born, right? So those things are all kind of intertwined. It's a chicken and egg story. It's hard to know which comes first. You know, the experience, the ideology, the symbol making, it's all kind of in a blender historically. And the change that goes with that is so radical for the people who make that choice, that change in identity, that to become a follower of the way was to have this super strong identification, like John does, with the character that inspired John to respond that way, which is the character of Jesus. So you can sort of see how that's all kind of tied together. So when John writes a text like that John 14 text, we get the full weight of his enthusiasm. We get the full weight of his, I found it. This is what's going on inside of me and my life, and I am just like, you are the most beautiful person in the world. Like, this, you are all of that to me. It's John's way of saying, Jesus is the way that I have found, and he's the only way. You are the person that I love, and you are the only one. It's that kind of language. And we can honor that truth without taking it literally. It's the hyperbole of the heart. It is the expression of honest, genuine feeling. Where we get into trouble is if we start to make doctrine out of hyperbole. Because now we're taking literally something that would be better, more truly taken otherwise. Wrong language. It's the wrong language on which to make things that we would like to speak of or have other people regard as absolute. That might be a hard thing to see in a different way than we were taught it, but I want to just share a story that reveals how that same text that we've been talking about looks from the vantage point of a respectful and insightful reader from another religious tradition. So this is a recorded story about a sermon that was preached on this text at Boston University School of Theology in the 50s. The preacher was a Hindu professor at the university. He was part of the faculty, and the faculty did the preaching and the chapel gatherings at this school of theology. It was a Methodist seminary, and so they followed methodically the lectionary. And on this day, this prof was scheduled to speak. The text in the lectionary was John 14:6. And so he read the text, read it aloud, and then he says to the gathered community, "This verse, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to Father or God, depending on your translation, except by me." He reads the text aloud, and then he says, "This verse is absolutely true. Jesus is the only way, and that way is known in every religion in the world." That's a different vantage point on that text, isn't it? It's interesting. It's another way of that prof saying Jesus is the incarnation of the universal truth and the universal path, not the incarnation of a unique and exclusive path unknown anywhere. Is Jesus unique? Absolutely. So is Tim. So is Teresa. So is the Buddha. So is Muhammad. For those that identify as Christians, and I know that's not all of us in this community, so don't mistake my point here. But for those that identify as Christians, Jesus is utterly central. Christians are people that find the decisive disclosure of God in Jesus. That's what makes them Christian. Just as Muslims are people who find the decisive disclosure of God in the Quran, or Jews are people who find the decisive disclosure of God in the Torah, or in many practices of indigenous traditions, as I understand them, people who find that disclosure of that mystery in Creator. That's what makes them Muslim or Jewish or indigenous when you see them, that identity question from the vantage point of religion. So through that lens, that's how that works. If we grew up around exclusivist thinking about verses or ideas like this, right at the moment like this, we might be sort of having a, you know, five-alarm fire in our brain as objections sort of flare up all over the place. And some of us could probably literally, in a moment like this, quote back to us the arguments that exist to disassemble that vantage point that I'm talking about. And so in the spirit of a community where we exist to explore what we believe, and where I realize that it's easy to dance around an exploration like this and kind of never, you know, fire it up, I want to leave us with a question. Because we all have sort of our own process in this and our own journeys in this. Here's the question. Does acknowledging the centrality of Jesus for those that live out their relationship with God or Spirit within that framework, the Christian framework, does that really require the dismissing or the devaluing of other ways of doing that? Other religions, other practices, other traditions? Do those things really have to be locked together? Because that's what an exclusivist claim does. It locks those things together. It says if you believe this, you can't give that equal value. Only one of these can be at the top of the pile. So that's what the question points toward. Or, to say it another way, is there a place for acknowledging that the tradition that shows a path, a way to God, to one person, that really sets that person's spirit ablaze with a sense of discovery and connection and transcendence? Is there a place for acknowledging that that kind of tradition really might not be the same tradition that shows a way to somebody else? So again, watch out for the language, right? Lots of us have been taught about the exclusive nature of these things on the basis of language. It's what it says. It's not just what it says, right? Who's saying it and why? From what experience? What kind of language is this? It's hugely important. I want to just leave us with that question for now, but I want to frame it as we go with another expression of devotion from a longtime friend of the table. Some of you will remember Trevor Williams. Yeah, a few heads nodding. For those of you that never got to meet Trevor, I'm sorry that you didn't. Really lovely human being. Trevor and I stay in touch. Trevor's in Calgary, and I don't have time to get into it, but we talked last week because he's starting a new job that is just like, it's astonishing that the organization he's working for is doing what they're doing in terms of making connections with a variety of faith organizations and social crisis. And anyway, it's a fascinating intersection, and he's remarkably well equipped for the job. So he was very excited, and it was lovely to hear about. He's also a spoken word artist, performer, and a poet. And he's been invited to be part of a larger spoken word event in Calgary that's coming up. And he's getting his set together. And he's like, Tim, I love Trevor, man. He just gets so excited, right? He's like, can I share a poem with you? Like, he'd always be really careful to check in. Like, he needs consent before he's going to share a poem. So he's just being that lovely guy that Trevor is. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be awesome. And so he just, on the phone, he just like shares this poem called Gratitude with me. And I said, Trev, like that, you know, once I kind of recovered a little bit, I'm like, that is awesome. And can I have it, you know, to do this with? Like, can I share it with the community? And he was like, yeah, no problem. And then I had another thought. I was like, but your voice, man. I mean, it's like, if I do it, it's a cover. It's still a good poem, but it's like, you know, I'm going to sing Elvis now or something. I don't, pick one. Like, pick something that, you know, wouldn't work. Wait a minute, I have covered Elvis at the table. Okay, that's maybe not the best illustration, but I was like, it would be a cover. And I, man, that's, we could have the real thing. Could you send me a recording? And so he did. So he recorded it and sent it to me. So I'm going to, if this works, I'm going to play Trevor's recording of this poem for us. Listen. Oh man, there's so many ways. I don't want to box the poem in, but I do want to give it this context. Listen to this as the language of lovers. Listen to this as an expression of someone for whom a particular path has been incendiary for them. It's just lit them up. But also somebody who understands that doesn't have to be everyone's path. And so the event that Trevor's going to offer this at is a public event. This is not the context is not religion. The context, if it's anything collective, it's social concern, you know, caring for the people on the margins. So,
this poem is called Gratitude. I know your face. You are the one who holds the strings of everything together, plucking them like a beautiful violin as moons and planets whirl around the sun. You are the edges of the hourglass, above and below all things, the container of time. My awareness of you is but a piece of sand and the fraction of that sand on the beach that is all knowledge. You are pure laughter that leads to welcome tears. You are harmony that unites the calm within me. You are joy at being able to perform an inspired creation in front of a room full of people. And you are serenity when I am alone and need only to be. You are the beautiful weaver, and you have woven goodness throughout all of the cosmos, and enjoy as your creatures engage within, as they are confounded, ecstatic, released, overwhelmed, grief-filled, awed, sorrow-filled, enjoying. May your beauty meet us all. May your beauty teach us all. May your beauty save us all.
And for those of you that, you know, enjoy or appreciate the classics, the last line is a nod to Dostoevsky's idea that beauty will save the world, right? Anyway, that's where I'm going to leave it. right there. I'm going to give the last word in this moment to Trevor and that poem.